Hey guys, I want to welcome you to the Mosaic Podcast. I'm Pastor Erwin Raphael McManus, and just wanted to thank you for listening. In case you didn't know, I just released a new book. It's called The Genius of Jesus, The Man Who Changed Everything. And you can order it today at thegeniusofjesus.com.
We're going to dive into a virtue that is really not one of the most attractive or desirable attributes. We know it's important because we enter into faith conversations, but it's not what you wake up in the morning thinking, I need more of this. If we have a conversation about success, room is packed. You have a conversation about how to achieve your dreams, achieve your goals, reach your destiny, unlock your potential, your talent, room is full. Talk about humility. It's not quite as scintillating, is it? You probably didn't wake up this morning thinking, I need to be more humble. What I'm really missing is a higher level or a higher degree of humility in my life. It's just not one of those things that we aspire to. But what we need to begin to connect is the dots between the person we long to be and the journey that it takes us to get there. Have you ever felt as if somehow you just kept missing your moment? That the world was unfair and other people had better opportunities than you, or maybe they just had more luck? And what you actually begin to discover as you step back in life is that everyone gets opportunities and everyone has moments that huge breakthroughs could happen, but what oftentimes happens is we lack the courage to engage those moments. What we're going to discover on this quest for honor is to live the life that God created you to live, you need to live a life of courage. And courage is really the tangible, practical outcome of this language we use when we talk about faith. Because it takes courage to live the life you were created to live. It takes courage to live the life God created you to live. But so many times we feel we have this deficit of courage, but we have no idea how to increase our courage. And what we're going to discover on this quest is that courage happens in the context of integrity. And integrity is this elusive dynamic inside of the human spirit where we begin to live integrated lives. And when we begin to live our lives from an internal compass that moves us to make decisions based on our character, not based on our circumstances, we begin to form what is described as courage. But so many of us have been on this journey for integrity, but we just can't figure out what the formula is to become a man or woman of integrity. And what we need to begin to connect the dots to is that integrity comes out of humility. But humility is not one of the world's most enviable attributes. When you were a kid, did you ever play pick up basketball or pick up football or pick up dodgeball, where you had two captains, usually the best athletes or the most popular kids, and then everyone else stood in line and then they picked you or didn't pick you? And have you ever been to that process? I'll take Steve. I'll take Brandon. I'll take Joe. I grew up in the middle of that misery. And I can tell you that pretty much for my entire childhood, I was always picked last. Now, I would love to say that's hyperbole or a metaphor, but no, I'm talking about accurate, literal history. I was always picked last. And since this is a conversation about humility, I'll go ahead and say I was probably the least talented person, but I wasn't always the least talented person. There was another dynamic, another variable involved. My brother was always one of the captains in our neighborhood. And our next-door neighbor, Hugh Smith, was the other captain. You see, it's so branded and scarred within my soul, I have never forgotten his name. And Alex and Hugh would always pick the teams, whether we were playing football or playing basketball or whatever it was. And they would flip on who goes first, and then they would start selecting everyone, and I knew that I wasn't going to get picked. No matter how hard I tried, no matter how much I worked at it, no matter how skilled I thought I was becoming, I was always the last guy picked because, you see, my brother would never pick me. And so the other captain knew that my brother would never pick me. There's no point in wasting a pick on the guy that's going to be there at the end. And so I was always there last. And sometimes the numbers would work when my brother had the last pick and I was the only one left. And he would literally say, you can have him. And so I was the guy picked after the last pick. if you ever even knew that pick was there. I hated it. I hated the process. I hated the experience. I hated how it made me feel inside, being last. So finally, one day, I woke up on a Saturday morning when we did a lot of our recreational activity, and I realized I'm never going to get picked first. I'm never going to get picked second or third. I'm always going to be picked last unless I'm the guy picking. So I got up that morning, I walked outside, and I put my stake in the ground, and I said, Hugh, today I'm the other captain. He didn't resist me at all. He said, you got it. I hate losing. And so he let me be the other captain. My brother picked him first, and they killed us. And then I realized the likelihood of me beating my brother's teams were very, very low, even if I tried to pick the best athletes available. So I began picking the worst athletes available. I decided, since I wasn't going to win anyway, I'm going to choose the guy who has never been picked first. And I started choosing from a reverse order, the worst athletes, the most unlikely candidate. And you could just see something happened inside of them, a visceral transformation when I would choose a person who had never been chosen so early in the lineup. I can tell you that week after week, game after game, we were wiped off the field. We had no chance, but I knew to lose with these guys brought them no true victory. But if the universe aligned itself exactly right, and eventually it did, me and my ragamuffin band, we finally conquered those giants and left them humiliated in their loss. There's nothing like finding a victory when you take the material that no one thinks you can overcome with. It set something inside of me, and I accidentally found a principle from Jesus. And there's something inside of all of us that fears being picked last and longs to being picked first, and it seems to violate all the information we have about the virtue of humility. After all, it's confident people who succeed, right? And confidence is just a degree off of cockiness, isn't it? Just a degree off of arrogance. And it's so easy to confuse conceit with confidence. And either way, it seems like the person who's proud and confident and arrogant, they're going to always overcome. And we have enough tangential and empirical evidence in this world to know that the proud seem to always have victory over the humble. So why should we value the virtue of humility in any case? Have you ever wanted to be the person God chose? You know, the person that God picked first. Have you ever wanted to be the person that God trusted with a big dream? God trusted with a big responsibility? That God used in a way that made a difference in the world. See, what I want to talk to you tonight is about how to become the kind of person God chooses. Because if humility has any value and any virtue, it is that it is the defining characteristic God looks for when he chooses a person to advance his cause. We see this all the way in Jesus in Philippians chapter 2, and we're going to go back to where we left off last week, beginning in verse 1. It says, therefore, if you have any encouragement from being united with Christ, if any comfort from his love, if any common sharing in the Spirit, if any tenderness and compassion, then make my joy complete by being like-minded, having the same love, being one in spirit and of one mind. Do nothing out of selfish ambition or vain conceit. Rather, in humility, value others above yourself. And if you've ever thought to yourself, well, what does humility look like? Here's some tangible manifestations of humility. Humility values others above themselves. Not looking to your own interests only, but each of you to the interests of others. The person who is defined by humility values others more than themselves and looks out not only for their own interests, but the interests of others. says, in your relationships with one another, have the same mindset of Christ Jesus, who being in very nature God, did not consider equality with God something to be used to his own advantage. Rather, he made himself nothing, by taking the very nature of a servant, being made in human likeness. And being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to death, even death on a cross. And so what we find in Jesus is that humility is ultimately expressed by choosing the posture of a servant. And that a servant's ultimate act of humility is when they make their lives a sacrifice for the good of others. Jesus marks a point in human history, a point from which conversations about humans, conversations about leaders, conversations about God changed forever. See, in Jesus, we find the manifestation of the ultimate expression of humility that drives this conversation tonight. Humility becomes our highest virtue because Jesus took it upon himself as his highest virtue. That the story of Jesus cannot be told without the humility of Christ. He did something else. He not only reframed for us what it truly means to be human, but he changed for us our concept of what leadership looks like. Jesus integrated this beautiful meshing of leadership and servanthood and introduced into human history the concept of servant leadership in a way that had never been manifest or materialized before. But those pale in comparison to what Jesus actually revealed to us about God. See, so many times when we talk about the humility of Jesus, the emptying of Jesus, Jesus choosing to become nothing, we see this as almost a contrast from who God is. And so Jesus humbled himself by leaving his divinity and becoming a human with us. Jesus leaves his majesty and chooses to become a servant. But what it implies is that God was experiencing something new. That God had never experienced the emotion or experience of humility. That God had never experienced what it felt like to be a servant. That God had never known what it meant to sacrifice. And this is exactly wrong. See, some of our theology, it betrays us. We talk about God as if he is the divine narcissist, right? Because God's ultimate intention is to glorify himself. That's what we say so often because that's what we've been taught. So everything God does, it's really all about him. What he really wants is for you to acknowledge how awesome he is. And so worship exists because God needs to be adored. And we're trapped in a universe that has been created by a narcissistic, emotionally needy creator. Worship me. Adore me. Glorify me. That's why I created you. And if the driving narrative of all creation, if the driving motive of creating humanity is simply to glorify himself, he did a really lousy job of it. Because most of us are not glorifying him. But if the driving central narrative of God is love, then everything begins to make sense. You see, Jesus reveals to us who we should be as humans. We should be a people who express the virtue of humility. He teaches us what a true leader looks like. A leader must be a servant of his people. But more than anything else, Jesus reveals to us something about God that is so profound and so provocative, it changes the view of God everywhere. See, from Greek to Roman, mythology, from the gods of the Norsemen to the gods of the Egyptians. Gods were an expression of all our longings and appetites. And it was perfectly acceptable to understand God as a God of power and fury, a God of wisdom and knowledge, a God who is all-present and all-knowing and all-powerful. All of those attributes made sense to us about who God is. But what Jesus was revealing to us is that God is more than simply all-powerful, that God is more than simply all-knowing, that God is more than simply all-present, but that God is the purest expression of humility. God is not only more powerful than us and more wise than us, God is more humble than us. Becoming a servant wasn't new to God. Jesus became a servant because it was natural to God to serve. Jesus chose the path of humility because it's the only path that God has ever taken. And so they spoke about the God of fire, the God of the winds and the God of the waters, the God of Hades and the God of the heavens. And from Odin to Zeus, from Neptune to Hermes, they spoke of all these gods with all these attributes that made them divine. But God is the God of humility. And his path is a path of servanthood. And so if we want to be like God, we betray ourselves when we want God's power and God's wisdom, but do not want God's character. Jesus gives us this mind because being in very nature God did not consider equality with God something to be used for his own advantage. Rather, he made himself nothing by taking the very nature of a servant, being made in human likeness. And being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to death, even death on a cross. What other path could God take except a path that serves out of humility? Jesus spoke to his disciples in Matthew 11, 29. He spoke to the multitudes and he said to them, "Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls." Do you hear what Jesus is revealing to us about the nature of God? You can trust me with your life. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me. Why? Because the heart of God is gentle and humble. Because this is who God is. And this is why God is worthy of all of our worship. Because God is a servant. It seems strange to say that, doesn't it? Seems demeaning to say God is a servant. Seems right to say God is all-powerful. Seems right to say God is all-wise. It seems right to say all these things about God that are true to his nature. And yet when we say God is a servant, it recoils us and bristles against us. And I think it's because it's the aspect of God we desire least. Because we genuinely do not see servanthood as an elevated status, but as something that is beneath God. And we hope against hope that it is beneath us. But Jesus says, "Come to me, for I am gentle and humble in heart." This is who God is. And so then it makes sense. If God is a God of humility, if God is a servant, and Jesus came and he materialized the very essence and nature of God, we see in Jesus the humble servant who would sacrifice himself for us, who God is, then it makes sense when you ask the question, who does God choose? What kind of person can God trust? What kind of person does God reveal himself and pour out himself into? It's the person who chooses the heart of God, who chooses to be humble in spirit. It's interesting that the scriptures give us a very clear breakdown to who God opposes and who God brings close. In James chapter 4, verse 6, it says, "But God, God gives us more grace. That is why the scripture says, God opposes the proud, but shows favor to the humble." Hear that again. God opposes the proud, but gives grace to the humble. If you've ever felt like you've just been fighting with God, or fighting against God, or God just isn't for you or with you, see, the only way you can ever get God to war against you is to choose the path of arrogance and pride. And in fact, when God chooses an individual, you find that the attribute he looks for at the core is humility. When God chose Moses to be the individual who led the people of Israel out of captivity from the Egyptians to become a nation, Moses was Israel's George Washington. And he chose Moses not because he was the most intelligent or the most skilled, the most competent. It says in Numbers chapter 12, verse 3, "Now Moses was a very humble man, more humble than anyone else on the face of the earth." I love that. God looked throughout the earth and picked the individual who expressed the greatest humility on the planet, because that humility is most reflective of the essence and character of God. I do want you to notice that this is a parenthetical thought about Moses, since Numbers is written by Moses. It would be very awkward for him to write that about himself. "Oh, by the way, I was more humble than everyone on earth." No, this is a parenthetical thought written in probably by Joshua, or someone who journeyed with Moses, not wanting us to miss the defining characteristic of this man who spoke face to face with God, and God called him his friend. That same Moses and his brother Aaron went to face Pharaoh, who was the most powerful man in the world. In Exodus chapter 10, verse 3, it says, "So Moses and Aaron went to Pharaoh and said to him, 'This is what the Lord, the God of the Hebrews, says. How long will you refuse to humble yourself before me? Let my people go so that they may worship me.'" Of all the other things Pharaoh most likely did against God, of all the other crimes that Pharaoh committed against humanity, God stands in this moment with one question: how long will you refuse to humble yourself before me? I want you to know something tonight. God will not reject you because you're too messed up. You may be a mess, but God is really good at doing amazing things through messy people. You may be here and you're broken, saying, "God could never do something amazing through me. You don't know how broken I am." God is incredibly creative in taking broken humans and doing beautiful things to them. Maybe you had a lifetime of failure. "I failed so much, there's just no way God could use me in an amazing way." I want you to know tonight, God will not oppose you because you are a failure. He will not put you aside because you're broken. He will not reject you because you're not intelligent enough or talented enough, educated enough, competent enough. But God will shelve you if you're too proud. See, God does not reject the sinful. He rejects the arrogant. And that's why it brings so much pain to God that we would resist him when he was the one who humbled himself first to bring us back to him. It's extraordinary that God is not asking us to do something he did not do. God says, "Humble yourself before the Lord and he will lift you up." But no one has humbled themselves more before humanity than God. God calls you and me to serve and lay our lives down for others. But if you haven't heard it yet, God stepped into human history and gave his life as a sacrifice for us long before he asked us to do that. See, God has never asked you to do anything in relationship to him or others that he has not already done, even more so for you and for me. Humility is kind of a strange dynamic, don't you think? There's a pendulum. You can think too highly of yourself or think too little of yourself. Humility is sort of in the tension of thinking that you're God and forgetting that you are created in God's image. So sometimes we confuse humility for an unhealthy self-deprecation, a lack of value. And that's not humility at all. Some of you have such an incredible lack of self-esteem and self-worth that you don't understand how immensely valuable you are to God. Hank took me to this place where we're doing this like neuroprofile, and they're checking our brains to see if they're functioning properly and letting us know what their rhythms and patterns and deficits are. I'm really excited about getting the feedback for that. And I discovered the CEO is a follower of Christ and a person of deep faith, and he started talking about how proud he was of his son, and just in response, just casual conversation, I said, you must be a really good dad. And he said, no, I'm a piece of shit. Now, that's unhealthy. And it struck me how here's a person who believes in God, who believes in Jesus, who's a person of the scriptures, who has clearly been informed by our theology, but what he's been taught is that only God is good, and since God is all about his glory, the rest of us, we're just a bunch of garbage. And you should be thankful that God even loves you, because he's the master and you're the servant and you're just worthless. I have a dog named Thatcher, what we do as a family. And you know, sometimes Kim will say, oh, that dog just loves you, Irwin. Look, you're her master. And she is very responsive, and she'll just lay at her feet and lay there. It's just so awesome to have a dog that works. And I thought about that. I am Thatcher's master. I love how my role as master works out for Thatcher. Because I'm the master, I have to make sure Thatcher has food to eat. That's my role as the master. Because I'm the master, I have to take Thatcher on walks, or maybe she takes me on walks, but I'm pretty sure it's me taking her on walks because I'm the master. Because I'm the master, I carry plastic bags in my pockets. And every time she decides it's time to relieve herself, I have to take one of those plastic bags and put my hand in it and grab all that and wrap it up. And I want you to know, you are not some meaningless piece of refuse that God has put in a plastic bag waiting to discard you. It's demeaning to you and dishonoring to God to think of yourself that way. Because the scriptures say that you are wonderfully and marvelously made, that you are infinitely loved by God. And don't buy into this false humility that says that you are nothing. See, you can't empty yourself to nothing if you don't have something to empty yourself of. And then there's that other side of it that says, I just want to be something more than I am because I really want my life to be all about me. And we all have this little voice inside of our heads that make us want to be something, don't we? Anybody here want to be great? I want to be great. I'm just going to own it. I want to be great. And the problem is that though Jesus says, if you want to be great, I have a process for you. See, if you want to be great in my kingdom, the kingdom of Jesus, in which we now choose to live, if you want to be great in my kingdom, you have to what? Be the servant of all. And I'm okay with that, as long as I know how long. I have to be a servant so that eventually, so I qualify for greatness. right? Because you can tolerate anything, even like being a servant, as long as you know eventually you get to be great. And because I think we're kind of dense, Jesus says, oh, okay, if you want to be first, I want to be first. I've been last. I know what last feels like. I worked really hard to be first. Jesus, sorry, if you want to be first, what you got to do is be last. I've been that. I know exactly how that feels, so I'm willing to be last, Jesus, so I can be first. All right, but how long do I have to be last? Maybe it's like one of those lines where you choose to stand at the back of the line, and then somebody comes out and goes, everybody turn around. See, the last shall be first. Now you're last. How do you like that? See, oh, Jesus is tricky. I know that's what's going to happen. And he says, okay, now, you see, if you want to have the most honor, if you want the place of great honor, you have to choose the place of least honor. Yeah, that's not really that much fun either. But we could choose the place of least honor if we knew we were going to get the place of most honor, right? I mean, wouldn't it be awesome to choose the place of least honor than have the master come in and say, no, what are you doing sitting there? Come, sit here. I'm going to sit down here strategically. Because I know he's going to be looking over here to pick whoever's going to sit over here, so I want to sit here. Have you ever been to a game where you bought tickets in the cheap seats and you saw empty seats in the expensive seats? And did you ever have a friend who was really bad, like a bad influence on all of you? And he kept saying, look, there's nobody sitting there. Let's go. Let's go down there. Let's take those seats. And you know it's wrong, but it feels so right. And then you finally, and no one comes, so you risk it. You move into those better seats, and then the people come late. They go, excuse me, can we see your tickets? And they bring, like, the concierge. Not that I've ever had this happen. I'm just saying that there's detail in this, but it's just coincidence. And you don't have the tickets, and they give you the opportunity to return to your seat of least honor. And you're very fortunate because if it happens more than once, they give you the opportunity to exit the building, and you lose your seat of least honor. Or have you ever been someplace and it was open seating, and you had a pretty good seat, but then you saw a better seat, so you tried to move the better seat, but someone sat in that seat faster, and so you went back to your other seat, but it was gone? Or a parking space? See, we're all okay with what Jesus is saying, as long as it's this Jesus J curve. You know what a J curve is? See, and so you realize, okay, we want to end up here. We want to get here, so it's a J curve, so we got to go down. I got to serve. Okay, so I'll serve, and I need to be last, so I'll be last. And okay, he says I got to have the least honor. Okay, as long as this J-curve eventually takes me to the place of most honor, of greatness and firstness, because this is where we want to go. But, you know, if you've been tracking with Jesus long enough, you realize it doesn't work that way, you see. He's very confused. See, he actually thinks that greatness is servanthood. That this is the final destination. See, he actually thinks that when you choose to be last, you are actually first. No adjustments need to be made. In his kingdom, the seat of least honor, the seat that chooses humility and servanthood and sacrifice, that's the seat of the most honor. See, the most extraordinary thing Jesus came to teach us about humility is that God is humble. That because we're created in his image and likeness, our souls thrive in humility. And if we want to be like God, then we need to choose the path of servanthood. Because it is only to the humble that God entrusts his power. It is only to the humble that God entrusts his glory. In John 13, we see this materialized in the person of Jesus in a way that has defined him for thousands of years. It was just before the Passover festival. Jesus knew that the hour had come for him to leave this world and go to the Father. Having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end. The evening meal was in progress, and the devil had already prompted Judas, the son of Simon Iscariot, to betray Jesus. Jesus knew that the Father had put all things under his power. This is a critical phrase. Jesus knew that the Father had put all things under his power, and that he had come from God and was returning to God. This was Jesus' moment, his epiphany. He knew who he was. He knew what his destiny was. He knew that all power and all authority had been returned to him. What would you do if you had all the power of God at your disposal? What would you do if you knew that you had all the authority of God and whatever you decided was going to happen? Can you imagine what would happen to the world if everyone's inner desires actually became reality? Hey, have you ever had some thoughts you regretted? Emotions that unleashed some negative desires for other people? Have you ever been on the intersection of the 405 and the 10 on Friday at 6? Have you ever been in the middle of road rage? Can you imagine what would happen if everyone in those cars could materialize their thoughts into reality if they had all the power? Everybody would be gone. Think how many siblings we would have left. How many of us at some point growing up didn't say, I just wish you were dead? No, several. How many of you haven't thought, oh, if I could just get rid of my boss? Or my boyfriend. Wow. We've touched a very sensitive chord here tonight. There is a reason why you do not have the unlimited power of God. It's because you cannot be trusted with it. You ever heard the old adage? Absolute power corrupts absolutely. It's so wrong. It's a beautiful cliche. And we just take cliches for granted, but it's absolutely incorrect. Absolute power does not corrupt absolutely. You know how I know that? Because God has absolute power and he is incorruptible. The problem is us. See, absolute power does not corrupt absolutely. Absolute power reveals absolutely. And what happens when a person gets more power than they have character is they use that power to overpower than to empower. They use that power to make slaves of others rather than to bring liberty and freedom to others. What do you do with your power? Your emotional power, your relational power, your political or business, economic power. See, Jesus knew that all power was under his authority, that he had come from God and was returning to God. So, because he knew all the power of God had been entrusted to him, so he got up from the meal, took off his outer clothing, and wrapped a towel around his waist. After that, he poured water into a basin and began to wash his disciples' feet, drying them with the towel that was wrapped around him. He came to Simon Peter, who said to him, Lord, are you going to wash my feet? Jesus replied, you do not realize now what I am doing, but later you will understand. No, said Peter, you shall never wash my feet. Jesus answered, unless I wash you, you have no part with me. Do you hear what Peter is saying to Jesus? Jesus, you will never wash my feet. You will never serve me. You will never be less or lower than me. Jesus, I cannot allow you to humiliate yourself this way. And Jesus says, unless I wash you, unless I serve you, unless I choose the path of humility and servanthood and sacrifice, you have no part with me. Then Lord Simon Peter replied, not just my feet, but my hands and my head as well. You might be here tonight and you thought that our ultimate goal was to get you to worship God. But there's a huge, huge step before that one. You see, before you are ready to worship God and live a life of service to God, you have to let God serve you. You have to experience the more difficult part of this process. You have to realize that you do not deserve, you are not worthy of such affection, such sacrifice, that God would choose to serve us, that God would humble himself and come to wash us and make us clean. And what God is asking of you, before you even have a conversation about you serving him, is let me serve you, Jesus says. And by the way, the reason he asked you for his life is because he gave you his life. He asked you only for what he was willing to give, and he gave more. He gave a perfect and sinless life. He asked for your broken and sinful life. He took on our sin in his death so that we would not die in our own sin. He humbled himself and took on the posture of a servant and gave himself as a sacrifice, even to death on the cross. And because God always exalts the humble, the story goes on. Therefore, God exalted him to the highest place and gave him the name that is above every name, that the name of Jesus, every knee should bow in heaven and on earth and under the earth, and every tongue acknowledge that Jesus Christ is Lord, to the glory of God the Father. Let it be known that God is the God of humility, that God is a servant, and that God has come to sacrifice himself on our behalf, to wash not only our feet, but our hands and our head, to wash not only our feet and our hands and our head, but to wash our souls, to make us clean from the inside out of all of our darkness, of all of our sinfulness, of all of our brokenness. And it is here that we find the kind of people that God trusts. You want to be the kind of person that God chooses? Choose to serve. Choose a life of humility. Choose this quest for honor. I remember when I was 29, I had spent those 10 years working with the urban poor. I don't think I ever spoke to more than 50 people on a Sunday. And we met in a duplex and then in a house, and it was this small little community of broken, messed up people. Most of our people were on welfare, people out of prostitution and drug addiction. And in that world, Kim worked in a much larger world. And every year, the place where she worked put on this huge event in Reunion Arena, where the Dallas Mavericks play basketball. And about 20,000 people would pack that arena, and they'd have speakers and things like that. And so I would volunteer to help Kim out, and I was what was called the directional advisor. I had this little light, and I would just point to the left, and people would go to the left, and then I'd point to the right. People went to the right, and I did it without much passion or affection, and I was just sort of a mechanical toy. And I had spent that week doing a camp. Now, I had done a few camps. I had done these little boys' camps, like 10 to 12-year-old boys. They're easy. Very, very short talks. And then you wrestle. It's easy. And you play football, you throw them up against walls, you knock them half unconscious. They're like, awesome! And boy, geez. But this was a week of girls' camp, and girls were exhausting. I'd never been in a world of little girls, and they were all like 10 to 12 years old. And when little boys would say, you know, let's wrestle, little girls go, let's talk. I spent 5 days talking, or really listening a lot. And they would come to me in clusters, because they move in clusters. And they'd all say, all right, memorize our names. And they would go, Melissa, Melinda, Belinda, Vanessa. And they would just go around, and they go, okay, now tell us our names. And I would just have to try to memorize all their names. And then they'd leave and come back like 3 hours later. All right, tell us who we are. Did you forget us? And it was exhausting. I just like desperate for escape, for relief, for testosterone. And so it was Friday, and I was done. I was just done. And it was that night we were supposed to go to serve at this event at Reunion Arena, and I was supposed to be the directional advisor in the back corner. And I just told Kim, I said, I'm not going. I've done this for the past several years. I can find someone else. And I said, I think they could take my part and give it to a trained monkey. And she goes, you're going. I said, no, I'm not going, honey. I've been serving all week long. I'm exhausted. I'm not going to go. She goes, you are going to go. And I said, no, I'm not. She goes, you are going to go. You gave your word. You made a commitment. You're going to go serve. And because I am the spiritual leader of our home, I changed my mind. And I decided it was right to go, and she left early because it was her job. And I left later as a volunteer. And I realized I don't have any clean clothes. And so I stopped by this, it was a Miller's Outpost, an old store, and I grabbed some blue jeans. But I didn't realize that jeans came in different sizes, so I just grabbed a really large, large pair that I had to tighten up. And I was like an early adopter of the cholo kind of, you know, style. And I didn't even take a Bible because I don't need a Bible to point. And when I got there, I was exhausted and as in a bad mood and probably had a bad attitude. And the guy in charge of the event, I didn't really like him. He didn't like me, I don't think, either. But one time I was at this event for pastors and they were all dressed in suits and I was there in my blue jeans and tennis shoes. And he came up to me and I was walking down the street. He goes, son, I just don't like when people call me son, and unless you're my dad, and I don't know my dad, so that pretty much cuts out everyone. And son, when you come to a meeting of pastors, you need to be wearing a suit. And that kind of rubbed me the wrong way, and I said, you know, I wore a suit yesterday for you guys, but today I'm going back into the real world. I know how to relate to my world a lot better than you do. He said, oh, you're probably right. And I realized he just chose the path of greater humility now that I look back on it. And that was our one really meaningful conversation. And then this event, there's like 20 preachers, like professional preachers, not people like me, wearing suits, following him around, hoping that the speaker wouldn't show up so that they could get picked to speak. And all of a sudden, this man comes up to me and he says, Irwin. Yes, Dr. McLeod? He said, Jay Strack isn't going to make it. I think the Lord wants you to speak tonight. And I thought, he's just mocking me. You know, he's kind of reeling me in. I go, oh, and he goes, oh, I just kid. I'd never have you speak. What are you talking about? So I laughed. I just started laughing because I didn't want to look like an absolute idiot and be humiliated in this moment. that's so funny. And this guy had really, really thick glasses. I mean, massively thick glasses that made his eyes huge, almost like reptilian. I mean, huge. And the man grabbed me. He said, Irwin, like that. The Lord. And I realized this man is serious and he's shaking me, telling me the Lord wants me to speak. And I'm thinking to myself, I've spoken to about 50 people, and this is 20,000 people, and I'm going to have about 45 minutes with no Bible. So I looked at the guy, and I thought, all right, you just got to ask. I said, well, I'm going to need a Bible. Didn't faze him at all. He goes, what translation? And so I told him, and they went and found me a Bible, and then this guy overheard, and he said, he just asked you to speak tonight? And I found out that the other speaker was on the golf course not answering his phone. And he picked me because I was dressed so poorly, he thought I would relate to all those students. And he said, "You're going to speak?" I said, I guess so. He goes, "Man, this is like one of those moments. This is an opportunity of a lifetime. Don't blow it." And then he walked off, and I just felt fear rushing through my whole body. And I saw this room, and I went inside, and it was empty, and I closed the door, and I fell on the floor, and I just started weeping. Just sobbing from overwhelming fear, going, "Oh God, it's a lot of people. I don't have a Bible. I don't have a talk. I just was praying, going, God, I don't want this. Would be humiliating. It could be really awful." And when I finished praying and just slobbering all over myself, I got up and I thought, I got to go tell Kim. So I went, and Kim was sitting at this desk. I don't know if she was doing registration or something. And I went and said, "Kim. Dr. McLeod asked me to speak tonight. Speak tonight." She goes, "I know." I said, whoa, "What do you mean you know? Did they tell you?" "No, I've known all day." I said, "What? Well, what do you mean you've known all day? Why didn't you tell me?" "Well, because it wasn't my place to tell you." What do you, "Did they tell you?" "No, they didn't tell me. God told me." I said, "What?" She goes, "Yeah, this morning. God told me that you were going to speak tonight. And that's why I needed you to be here. So that you could speak." I said, "Well, why didn't you tell me? Because I would have come if you told me God told you I was going to speak." She goes, "No, because you needed to be here to serve, not to speak." I hate that. I hate it. It's... You see, what just a little side note, what the scriptures tell us is that humility is a choice. It's not a gift. It's not some kind of spiritual magic that gets dropped on. There's no angel dust that makes you humble. You have to choose a life of humility. But if you don't choose to humble yourself and you leave it in God's hands, it's called humiliation. The beautiful thing about a person who walks in humility and is that they cannot be humiliated, because there's nowhere to fall, because they're already standing on their two feet, a people of the earth. By the way, the word humility, humus, just means earth, dirt. I love the fact that when God decided to create a creature in his image and likeness, he took the most common material in the universe. Because that's the kind of material God loves to use. And so when Jesus came and walked among us, when he washed his disciples' feet, when he took the beatings and allowed himself to be crucified, these were not new choices for God. God has always chosen to be a servant. For humility is his highest virtue. Because God can be trusted with all power. Because the only thing that restrains him is his character. And if you want God to trust you with the dreams he has for your life, if you want God to trust you with the power of his Spirit, if you want God to trust you with a slice of his mission and purpose in the world, then choose to be like him. Choose to serve in humility.
Thank you so much for joining us on the Mosaic Podcast. I want to encourage you to take the message you just received and allow it to go deeply into your soul. Let Jesus do the deep work that only he can do. A special thank you to everyone who gives to Mosaic. Your sacrifice makes this podcast possible and creates life change all over the world. You can be a part of spreading this message around the world by going to mosaic.org/give. You can also subscribe, rate, and share this podcast with your friends and family. Thanks again for listening. God bless you.